From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Welcome to the premiere of the daily edition of Fresh Air. Each day on Fresh Air, you'll hear from people at the forefront of the arts, entertainment, and contemporary culture. We start our first show with a celebration of Irving Berlin's 99th birthday. Singer Peggy King will be here to perform some of her favorite Berlin songs for us. Also on today's show, exiled Chilean novelist Isabel Allende talks about her second book of Love and Shadows. Music critic Francis Davis says a new recording of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue lets us finally hear the piece the way Gershwin intended it. And TV critic David Bianculli says goodbye to Hill Street Blues. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Today we're celebrating Irving Berlin's 99th birthday. It's an occasion worth making a fuss over. Think of all the great songs he's given us. Anthems like God Bless America, holiday songs like White Christmas, dancing songs like Puttin' on the Ritz, and love songs like Cheek to Cheek and Always. We've invited singer Peggy King, whose beautiful voice does justice to Berlin's great music. In the early 50s, she was under contract to the MGM film studio, where she was groomed to be Judy Garland's successor. She became a singing star in the mid-50s through her frequent appearances on TV variety shows and her role as co-star on The George Gopal Show. I first heard Peggy in the early 1980s. She'd just returned to performing after a 20-year break to raise her family. Now she's recording again and performing at Manhattan's top singers' clubs. Accompanying Peggy King is pianist, arranger, and producer Michael Abeni, who has played with many great singers, including Liza Minnelli, Chris Connor, Joe Williams, and Anita O'Day. I want to welcome you both to Fresh Air, and why don't you get us started with a song?
Absolutely. Come get together, let the dance floor feel your leather. Step as lightly as a feather, let yourself go. Come, hit the timber, loosen up and start to limber. Can't you hear that hot marimba? Let yourself go. Let yourself go. Relax and let yourself go. Relax, you got yourself tied up in a knot. The night is cold, but the music's hot. So come, cuddle closer. Don't you dare to answer no, sir. Butcher, banker, clerk, and grocer, let yourself go. Come, get together. Let the dance floor feel your leather. Step as lightly as a feather. Let yourself go. Come, hit the timber. Loosen up and start to limber. Can't you hear that hot marimba? Let yourself go. Let yourself go. Relax and let yourself go. Relax, you got yourself tied up in a knot. The night is cold, but the music's hot. So come, cuddle closer. Don't you dare to answer no, sir. Butcher, banker, clerk, and grocer, let yourself go. Let yourself go. Let yourself go. Go.
That sounds terrific.
Thank you. That's Fred Astaire sang that in Follow the Fleet.
Peggy, you've been singing a lot of Irving Berlin songs during this past year and throughout your singing career as well. As a songwriter, does he really keep track of how singers are singing his songs?
Yes. I always say in my nightclub act that we may have a little excitement here tonight, because if I sing a wrong lyric, he'll be here. From wherever he is, he'll arrive, because no, he's very fussy.
How so?
Well, the reason I think is because he writes his own music. He writes lyrics and music, and when that happens, I believe that the marriage is very important to him. He knows exactly what note he wanted on what word, and he doesn't want you to fool around with it.
Okay.
And since I've been writing lyrics myself, I'm very sympathetic to that. I really know how he feels.
Why don't you do another song for us?
We're going to do three.
A medley.
The reason here is that these are the three great love songs, and we just had to do all three, so it's a medley. All alone, I'm so all alone. There is no one else but you. All alone by the telephone, waiting for a ring, a ting, a ling. I'm all alone every evening, all alone, feeling blue, wondering where you are and how you are. And if you are all alone too, say it isn't so, say it isn't so. Everyone is saying you don't love me, say it isn't so. Everywhere I go, everyone I know whispers that you're growing tired of me, say it isn't so. People say that you found somebody new, and it won't be long before you leave me, say it isn't true, say that everything is still. That's all I want to know. And what they're saying, say it isn't so. Gone is the romance that was so divine. It's broken and cannot be mended. You must go your way and I must go mine, but now that our love dreams have ended, what'll I do when you true, what'll I do?
was a beautiful medley. You know, Peggy, sometimes I think we almost forget about Berlin's wistful songs like that because we remember all the flag-waving type songs and the big anthems.
It's true, but his love songs are... I'm usually very controlled. You know, I'm an actress and I don't get, teary. But I get teary when I sing his songs. They're so wistful. They're so sad. He almost takes his heart out and says, here it is. Also, Michael plays them, especially, I feel Berlin when Michael plays. I can't sing Berlin with just anybody.
He really writes such vernacular lyrics. They really sing like people speak. What'll I do?
And they spoke at each time he was writing, at each decade that went by. He's almost a chronicle of how we were talking in those days. Really, I did a play of his about the 60s, Mr. President, and it was full of the 60s jargon. He's sort of like a historian for American music for me.
You're going to do a song that I associate with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Actually, this is really a man's song, but it's I've always wanted to sing it, so this is it.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's music and laughter and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Before the fiddlers have fled, before they ask us to pay the bill, and while we still have a chance, let's face the music and dance. Soon we'll be without the moon, humming a different tune. And then there may be teardrops to shed, but while there's music and laughter and love and romance, let's face the music.
Play it, Mike.
You had mentioned, Peggy, you think of that as a song for a male voice and for a man to sing. Did Berlin write in different ranges depending on who he was writing for?
He wrote that
man
for
or a woman.
Astaire, too. Yeah, he wrote a lot of the early things are very soprano-ish and hard for me to sing because I'm certainly not a soprano. I can sing the songs mostly they wrote for Garland. They're right in my range. But there are problems. You know, Astaire had that little high voice, that wonderful high voice, and they get very high. That one gets very high. But I love it.
Funny you should mention Garland, because she'll be singing a song that he wrote for her in a couple of seconds. But first, we're going to take a short break. We're going to continue our celebration of Irving Berlin's 99th birthday. After this break, this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
We're celebrating Irving Berlin's 99th birthday with a concert of his songs. My guests are singer Peggy King and pianist and arranger Michael Abeni. Peggy, you were about to sing a song associated with Judy Garland, though I should say it's a song probably a lot of our listeners have never even heard.
I can remember sitting in the theater as a little girl of about, I don't know, 12, 13, seeing Easter Parade, which this is from, and seeing Garland sing. And I could hardly wait to get out of the theater and try it out myself. I love this song.
Well, you know, later on in your life, you were groomed to be a successor to Judy Garland at
MGM.
Yes,
that was my fate at Metro.
You sounded so much like her when you
sang. And they also felt I looked like her. I never thought. There's just a placement of the voice. It comes from the same place.
So what do you think of now when you sing a song associated with her?
I never think about it. I really feel that the song is mine when I'm singing it. For that little moment, it belongs to me.
You shied away from
her actually,
material
for a while. Actually, it belongs to Mr. Berlin.
Right, that's right. You shied away from her songs for a while?
I did. I didn't sing anything of hers for a long time. And then everybody started to sing her songs. And then her daughters came along and were singing them. And then I figured, what the heck? I'll sing them too.
Why don't you sing it for us now?
I will. Better luck next time, that could never be. Because there ain't gonna be no next time for me. No siree, made up my mind to make another start. I've made my mind up, but I can't make up my heart. I'd like a new lucky day. That would be nice. But this comes just once in a lifetime, not twice. So don't say, better luck next time, that could never be, because there ain't gonna be no next time for me. I'd like a new lucky day, that would be nice, but this comes just once in a lifetime, not twice. So don't say, better luck next time, that could never be, because there ain't gonna be no next time for me.
It's a wonderful song. It's really a shame
but
it's
you
not
see how
sung
he
more
puts,
often.
You see how he puts the notes together at the end? There's no way not to sound like Garland.
Uh-huh.
No way.
It's quite a range in that song,
too. It's a rangy song, and you have to play with it. And she went for the belting notes, and I don't always like to do that, especially not on the radio. And so it's it gets a little more wistful. I don't know. I love that song. So does Michael. He loves it, too.
Michael, what's Berlin like to play at the piano? Is there anything that separates him from from the other great American songwriters?
Well, there's so many. Each song is almost very different, and some are so harmonically simple and melodically simple and as a player now, okay? Mm-hmm. And some are so harmonically complex. I mean, things you wouldn't, even the song Supper Time, which you wrote for Ethel Waters, which is, I mean, I would never think that was a Berlin song. And there are so many things like that that it's sort of, all of a sudden, he throws you on the left foot. You know, it's like, oops, my goodness. You know, they're a lot of fun to play for instrumentalists. I think there's a lot of goodies from an instrumental point of view. And lyrically, they're all very strong. But even lyrically, you know, like the lyrics to that song we just mentioned, Supper Time, and things like that. I mean, it's hard to believe it's the same guy. The guy wrote Annie, Get Your Gun. I mean, in those things, it's hard to believe a lot of those things are Berlin even. And for some reason, it's just so many different directions.
He's very deceptive.
Let's get another example of his diversity.
For instance, here we go. This is in another world from the song we just sang. And this is from Ziegfeld Follies of 1927. Shaken. Yeah, Shaken. Shaking the booze away, unhappy news away. If you are blue, it's easy to shake off your cares and troubles. Telling the blues to go, they may refuse to go, but as a rule, they'll go if you'll shake them away. Do like the voodoos do, listening to a voodoo melody. They shake their bodies so, to and fro. With every shake, a lucky break, proving that there's a way to chase your cares away. If you would lose your weary blues, shake them away. Shaking the blues away, unhappy news away. If you are blue, it's easy to shake off your cares and troubles, telling the blues to go. They refuse to go, but as a rule they'll go if you'll shake them away. Do like the voodoos do, listening to a voodoo melody. They shake their bodies so, to and fro. With every shake, a lucky break, proving that there's a way to chase your cares away. If you would lose your weary blues, shake them away. Shake 'em away, shake 'em away. What could be more different?
Yeah, what a great song. The next song you're going to do, How About Me, is also a song that's not very well known. It's really one of my favorite Berlin songs. It's such a pretty and very sad song.
1 year later, 1928, from a play called Coquette. And if there's a song that puts me on the floor, this is the song.
But you won't let yourself cry
while
you're
singing. I will not
get
put on the floor. No. What?
But you never let yourself cry
while
you're singing.
Well, there's a secret to that. Phil Harris once told me that the secret to making an audience cry is not crying yourself. If you cry yourself, they'll figure, well, she's doing it, why bother? But if you aren't crying, but you're just about, and they can see that you're trying not to, then they'll all cry. At least that's my theory. It works. It usually works. We did this once at a concert here in Philadelphia at Settlement Music School. And when we got to the end of the song, people were really sobbing. In the first place, there were people who were of the age group that they knew the song. And it really is a poignant song.
It's a beautiful song. Why don't you sing it? Okay.
It's over. All over, and soon somebody else will make a fuss about you. But how about me? It's over, all over, and soon somebody else will tell her friends about you. But how about me? You found somebody new, but what am I to do? I'll still remember you. baby will climb upon your knee and put its arms about you. But how about me? You found somebody new, but what am I to do? I'll still remember you when you have forgotten. And maybe a baby will climb upon your knee and put its arms about you. But how about me?
That was beautiful. Can I make a request for our last song for this concert?
Of course you can.
Could you end it with Always?
Yes. Would you like to hear something wonderful about Always? He gave it to his wife as a wedding present. The copyright, the ASCAP rights. I think it's the most wonderful present since the Taj Mahal. Everything went wrong, and the whole day long I'd feel so blue. For the longest while, I forgot to smile. Then I met you. Now that the blue days are past, now that I found you at last, I'll be loving you always, with a love that's true, always. When the things you've planned need a helping hand, I will understand. Always, always, days may not be fair, always. That's when I'll be there, always. Not for just an hour, not for just a day, not for just a year, but always.
Thank you both for that beautiful performance. It was a wonderful way to celebrate Irving Berlin's birthday. Thank you both very much. Pianist Michael Abene, singer Peggy King, thank you both so much for being with us. We'd like to thank the Wilmington Piano Company for use of the concert piano. On the next edition of Fresh Air, I'll speak with syndicated political columnist David Broder. His new book is a critique of the way news is reported, so I hope you can join us. Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. Additional funds come from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia. I'd like to say happy birthday, Irving Berlin. This is NPR National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming Coming up, novelist Isabel Allende talks about her life in exile following the assassination of her uncle, Chilean President Salvador Allende. A Latin American country under a dictatorship is the setting of her latest book of Love and Shadows. Also, music critic Francis Davis reviews a new recording that recreates the adventurous 1924 concert which premiered Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. TV critic David Bianculli takes a last look at Hill Street Blues, and we'll have a news update from National Public Radio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Time for the latest news. This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Francis Davis has a review of a new recording of one of the most frequently performed works by an American composer, George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Francis says this new version turns out to be an old version.
George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue occupies a curious place in the modern orchestral repertoire. Essentially a piano concerto, it's a bounding showpiece for soloist and orchestra, a real crowd pleaser. But conductors treat it as a diversion, a relief from weightier standard concert fare. It's almost as though it's on the program as an affirmative action on behalf of 20th century American composers. Meanwhile, Rhapsody in Blue's misrepresentation as fodder for the likes of Arthur Fiedler alienates the jazz and pop audiences to whom this masterpiece rightly belongs. Rhapsody in Blue was commissioned by the dance band leader Paul Whiteman and given its premiere by Whiteman's orchestra at New York's Aeolian Hall on Lincoln's birthday in 1924 with Gershwin himself on piano. This concert marked the first intrusion of a classical music sanctuary by an American dance band. Its stated purpose was to make an honest woman out of jazz, a well-meaning sentiment that's done nothing to endear Whiteman or Gershwin to those of us who hear nothing particularly whorish about jazz unwed to the symphony. 3 years ago, in celebration of the 60th anniversary of the concert, conductor Maurice Perez mounted a recreation of nearly all the music performed at Aeolian Hall that night, including Rhapsody in Blue and works by Victor Herbert, Cees Comfrey, Freddie Groffé, and Rudolph Frimmel. Now there is a digital studio recording of Perez's recreation. It's titled The Birth of Rhapsody in Blue. It's a 2-LP set on the Music Masters label. To say that Perez and piano soloist Ivan Davis's interpretation of Rhapsody in Blue is different from any other on record isn't critical hyperbole, merely a statement of fact. For starters, Perez has reinserted piano and orchestral passages which were excised for reasons of space from the presumably definitive recording that Gershwin made with Whiteman shortly after the premiere. But more important, Perez has reclaimed the work for jazz by restoring saxophones and banjo to the position of dominance they enjoyed in the original dance band orchestration. The difference in harmonic shimmer and rhythmic punch is astonishing, most noticeably on that celebrated slow finale.
Thank you.
If this record gives an accurate representation, Rhapsody in Blue outclassed everything else performed at Aeolian Hall that night. But the other stuff was pretty delightful, however minor. Surprisingly, the pieces one would have thought would date most badly are among the set's freshest sounding. For example, the tearjerker to An Irish Rose, or better still, this, Rudolf Rimmel's Chansonnette. An excerpt from Rudolf Rimmel's Chansonnette, or Donkey Serenade, as it was unfortunately retitled after being saddled with lyrics. I suppose it's easy to dismiss music this prim as period kitsch, but only after acknowledging what a fertile period this was and what noble kitsch it produced. Although most of the music on The Birth of Rhapsody in Blue registers as quaint today, one can make a case for it as postmodern in its willingness to toss everything into the Cuisinart. Today's postmodernists should be as savvy as the class of 1924 and knowing where to shop for fresh ingredients. Paul Whiteman's Aeolian Hall concert was a landmark in American music. So is Maurice Perez's loving recreation.
Francis Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. He also writes about jazz for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Chilean novelist Isabel Allende. She's the niece of slain Chilean President Salvador Allende. She now lives in exile in Venezuela. Allende's first novel, The House of the Spirits, dazzled readers in Europe, Latin America, and this country. Her novels are elaborate, magical tales set against a political backdrop. Her new book is called Of Love and Shadows. The story takes place in an unnamed Latin American country. A young couple discover a mass grave in a mine where victims of the dictatorship have been dumped. I asked Isabel Allende if the story is based on a real incident.
Yes, in 1978 in Chile, the Catholic Church opened a mine, an abandoned mine, and they found 15 bodies there. They had been killed by the military in 1973. Among the bodies were five members of the same family, and that's where I got the idea from.
Were they people that you knew?
No, they were peasants that had been killed. Many people were killed at that moment.
What was the personal connection you felt with that story? It obviously meant a lot to you.
When I read the story, I was living in Venezuela. I thought about the women in that family, the mother, the daughters, the wives, sisters. They had been searching for their men during 5 years, asking for them in the morgue, in the hospitals, in the concentration camps, in prisons, everywhere. And during all that time, they couldn't bury them or even cry. So I thought about that family a lot, and that family symbolized for me all desaparecidos, people who disappear.
The characters in your novel who discover the murder and then expose it are forced into exile. What were the circumstances under which you went into exile?
After the military coup, I stayed in Chile for many months because I thought that the dictatorship couldn't take very long leaving. We would have a democratic country again. We had no tradition in dictatorship or in repression. But finally, I was afraid. I had been working with the Catholic Church. I'm not a Catholic personally, but that was the only organization that was still working, the social organization that was working. So I got in touch with the priests in the slums, and I started working with them. And finally, I was very much afraid because me and my husband, we were more and more involved, and we thought that we were in danger.
Were there any threats made against your life?
Well, only on the telephone. Of course, I lost my job and that, but very little. Many people were really threatened and beaten in the streets and taken into prison, and many disappeared.
Did you have to sneak out of the country?
No, I left with a passport.
If you had stayed and left later, would it have been that easy to get out?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think I left at the right moment.
That's always difficult to tell, isn't it? What is the right moment to leave?
It's very difficult, and you always have this guilty feeling that maybe you should have stayed, and staying, you could do more, or something at least. But now I don't feel that guilt because I'm able to write, and I go all over the world speaking against the dictatorship, and in a way I'm working against it.
You didn't really start writing novels until you were living in exile. What was it about exile that made you turn to novel writing?
You know, at the beginning I felt paralyzed, as a tree without roots. I felt that all the memories of the past were, I was losing them, that all that had been my life, my family, my country, everything I had before was lost. And that's a very paralyzing feeling. But then, after some years, when my grandfather died in Chile, I started writing a letter to my grandfather to tell him that he could die in peace because I had all his memories with me. And to prove that I had forgotten nothing, I started writing about the things that he had told me when I was a child. Well, finally, I went on. My grandfather died, and I went on writing and writing. And after a year, I had 500 pages on my desk and nobody to send them to. So I thought, well, maybe this is a novel.
Has novel writing become a way to keep alive your memories of Chile and stories that you want to tell?
Yes, that's exactly. I feel much better now. I have all the past with me, and there are so many beautiful stories to tell, not mine, but stories of other people. When I finished The House of the Spirits, my mother said, "Oh God, you've put everything there. There's nothing left for another book." And I said, "No, there are many, many stories, and there are really."
You are a wonderful storyteller.
Oh, thank you.
Are there storytellers in your family? Were you told a lot of stories when you were growing up?
There is an oral tradition in my family. Women tell stories, and most of those stories were told by my mother. And she lives in Chile now, and she writes a letter every day, and many of those letters contain stories that she tells me so that I can write them.
I once read that when you were a child, you'd listen to soap operas on the radio.
I still do.
But in this piece I was reading, it said that your grandfather tried to forbid you from listening to the soap operas.
Well, he thought they were very vulgar. So he was a personal enemy of the radio because he said that those were unknown voices that came into your house and who knows what vulgarities they would be saying. He was a very conservative and strict man.
Did listening to these stories on the radio start to take on this this allure because they were taboo in your house?
Yes, I think I loved them because they were forbidden. And we would hide in the kitchen and hear these incredible stories. One of them, the first one I heard in my life, it came from Cuba, and it was called The Right to be Born. You can't imagine what that was. an illegitimate child that finds his mother, and finally he says, "Mother," and she says, "My son," and they both embrace. That was the sort of stories that we read, we heard in the radio.
I guess soap operas are the same in every country.
Yeah, I love them.
Do you think soap operas have influenced your writing at all?
Of course, I write soap operas. My books are like soap operas, aren't they?
But soap operas with do you think of them as soap operas in a political setting?
It could be. It could be. I mean, I can't avoid speaking about politics or social problems, but there are love stories and a lot of violence in them, and they are soap operas, finally.
There are characters in your books who believe in spells and mystical powers and esoteric herbal potions. Was there anyone in your family who believed in those things?
Well, don't you?
Well, sometimes.
In my family, everybody did, and I still do. And these things are very common in Latin America. Of course, my grandmother was a clairvoyant, and she would do all the spiritism and all these things. But she didn't believe, I think, that she didn't believe really in ghosts. She thought that the house was haunted by the passions and obsessions of the people who lived in the house. Those were the spirits. So dreams were important, and feelings were very important. It was an unknown, invisible dimension of life.
How many years have you been in exile now?
12.
How has the experience of being in exile changed in those 12 years? Do you miss your country with the same ferocity that you did?
No, because somehow I have become a citizen of Latin America. Now I care for the whole continent. I think that we have a common destiny. We have had 500 years of exploitation and colonization. That makes us all brothers and sisters. And I think if we want to be saved from misery and underdevelopment and violence, we have to work together. So now I don't feel a foreigner any longer in the rest of Latin America. When I'm in Latin America, I feel at home. But of course, I miss my landscape, my friends.
Your mother still lives in Chile. Why did she stay
there? No, she went back to Chile. She had not lived in Chile for the last 15 years. She was a diplomat when the military coup occurred. They were ambassadors in Argentina, where they were threatened to death, and they had to leave. So now, when my stepfather is 70, he decided he didn't want to die in a foreign country. He wanted to go back. So they went back recently.
Do you think they're safe there?
Yes, I hope they are.
Would you go to visit them?
No, I can't.
Isabel Allende, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Isabel Allende spoke with us from the NPR studios in New York. Her new book is called Of Love and Shadows. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you following this evening?
Well, we're following, of course, the testimony before the Joint Congressional Committee by Robert McFarlane, President Reagan's former national security advisor, about the Iran-Contra affair.
The Klaus Barbie trial started today.
Yes, and in addition to a report by Nina Sutton from Lyon, where the trial is happening, we'll also be hearing from Beata Klarsfeld and Erna Paris, two people who have both written a great deal about the Barbie case. Also, on the lighter side, the national pun-off in Texas figures in today's program, as does an interview with the man who cracked and computerized the secrets of the knuckleball.
Well, Robert, no time for your puns. We're out of time. Thank you. Robert Siegel co-hosts All Things Considered, which is coming up later on National Public Radio. This week, after seven seasons, NBC will present the final episode of Hill Street Blues. Our television critic David Bianculli looks back on the show that revolutionized series TV.
I I never was much good about saying goodbye, and it's doubly tough to say farewell to Hill Street Blues. I'm not just sorry to see it go, I also feel a little bit guilty. That's because I wasn't fiercely loyal to Hill Street at the start, or in its final few seasons. I've made a point of watching the last few episodes, and I'll certainly make a point of watching this week's grand finale. Hill Street, however, crept up on me slowly. Many people remember the pilot episode of Hill Street, either from its 1981 premiere or from the many times it's been repeated. The look and texture of the show was very unusual for television, much more suited to a movie by Robert Altman. Unfortunately, I gave that first show a mixed review. At the time, I thought the scriptwriters had sacrificed character development for cheap laughs. In particular, they had the fatherly desk sergeant, played by Michael Conrad, ready to marry a high school cheerleader. Took me a few weeks of watching to realize that it wasn't just a cheap laugh. Instead of forgetting about that impending wedding, Hill Street followed it and followed it all the way to the altar, leading to the scene when Grace Gardner, rather than lose the sergeant to the cheerleader, visits him just before the wedding and opens her overcoat. There was nothing underneath but amazing grace. By the fifth show, I was a total convert. As that plotline proceeded, Hill Street proved two things. First, that TV could take an original adult approach to the cop show. Second, that it could spill its plots over several episodes, behaving more like a miniseries than a weekly series. Hill Street, of course, made it easy to accept Saint Elsewhere, Call to Glory, and L.A. Law from their first episodes. But while Saint Elsewhere has continued to evolve and have fun, Hill Street has been enlivened only by the casting of Dennis Franz as Norman Bunce. I still watch the show, but I no longer make long-distance calls to track down taped copies if I miss one. Something changed, and I think it's that Hill Street hasn't changed enough. Even when it headed in the right direction, it stopped short. Ferrillo didn't quite fall off the wagon. Davenport didn't quite have an affair. Goldblum didn't quite get married. And Hunter didn't quite kill himself. Maybe it's in poor taste to be critical rather than reverent, but there's a compliment in here somewhere. Hill Street Blues single-handedly raised the expectations of series television. It was, in its first two seasons, the very best show on TV, and its slow but steady success made other high-reaching shows possible. The problem for Hill Street is that the reach of other shows eventually exceeded Hill Street's grasp. Hill Street Blues is still better than 90% of the shows on the air, but it's no longer the best. It's retiring with dignity and strength, but not as the champ. Yet its legacy lives on, and at more than one network. At this point in TV history, Moonlighting is to ABC what Hill Street was to NBC, its first and proudest bastion of quality, and a signal to viewers that things are about to get better. A little of Hill Street will also live on in spirit in every Saint Elsewhere, in every L.A. Law, even in every Cagney and Lacey. Next season, there's bound to be a more direct legacy, assuming that NBC makes room for Beverly Hills Bunce, the Hill Street spinoff starring Dennis Franz. If not, viewers can start scouring their local listings. Few TV shows these days really die, or fade away. They just move to off-network syndication. As for the Hill Street actors, now free to pursue other Hollywood projects, I have a few words of advice. Let's be careful out there.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's what's coming up on our next show. Next time, I'll speak with film director Stephen Frears. He's best known for My Beautiful Laundrette. His new film, Prick Up Your Ears, is about the life and death of gay British playwright Joe Orton. Rock critic Ed Ward will make a case for reconsidering Bo Diddley as a folk poet. And book critic John Leonard will review A Sport of Nature, the latest novel by South African writer Nadine Gordimer. It's about a white woman's sexual and political awakening on the eve of South Africa's revolution. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistant, Ed Doherty. Engineer, Joyce Lieberman. Chris Bergen directs the show. The Fresh Air theme is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.